Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hi, Matt.
Hey, how are you?
Very well. Refreshed.
Suntanned and refreshed and everything else.
Yeah, bit of a holiday away and went away to Hong Kong for the sevens for a few days. Did a bit of work out there, brought the family, and then went on to Thailand for another week after that.
Where were you in Thailand? In an island or something?
Yeah, Phuket.
Ah, nice.
So went there for the first time with Sarah back in about 2008, I think it was. So happy memories from there. Been back a couple of times since. But took the bike with me, suffered my way up, climbed up there. Big shout out to Mark Plunkett, who's he's actually Ronan Keating's manager, but he's a friend of mine, him and his wife Claire, who live out there for half the year and then back in the UK for the other half. But went out with him on the bike and his pals. Just absolutely savage. There's no such thing as a flat road. It's either like 20% up or it's 20% down. But
ridiculous temperature, I imagine, as well.
Yeah. So doing the opposite of what I normally do, you know, getting up at the crack of dawn, leaving as soon as it's light enough to ride your bike, because it's, you know, even at sunrise it's 27-28 degrees. So really nice, really good fun, change of scenery. Kids had a great time, went to Disneyland in Hong Kong. went to the Sevens and had the Doddy dinner out there for the M&D charity, for Doddy Weir's charity. Just some real legends out there, some proper rugby superstars, you know, from present era back to the good old days back in the 80s, 90s that I remember.
Great. Sounds fun.
What about yourself? Anything exciting over the Easter holidays?
So we had the first week off, went to see my brother for a bit and some friends for another bit, but otherwise I've been working. But I've got quite a surreal experience tonight in that I'm going to a trance jam session with Steve Davis, the former snooker player, tonight. So I'm interviewing him because he's, you know, it's funny, he was called Mr. Boring, but he has this other side where he does electronic and trance music. And so there's a thing happening in Bristol tonight. So I'm going to do that as like a world championship preview. It's funny, just exchanging text messages with him and him telling me we're meeting in some random pub around the corner and off to trance night. I don't know what it entails, but I thought I'd mention it because it feels like a sporting misadventure in its own right. So that's nothing eventful's happened, but maybe that will be tonight.
Steve Davis is one of my heroes when I was growing up. I loved snooker. I loved it when I was, you know, a wee boy. Always remember that final with Dennis Taylor, 85. The classic final when it was 17-all down the final frame, the final ball to win it. Steve Davis, he was on Chatterbox podcast. He was a guest and I listened to him.
He was brilliant on it, wasn't
he? Yeah, really good. And he is such a... And it never has somebody so unfairly received, you know, a nickname or a persona that just didn't match their true persona. You know, the sort of boring, or it was Steve Interesting Davis as the kind of, you know, as an ironic nickname he was given. But actually, yeah, what an interesting guy, what a funny guy, and what a talented guy.
Yeah, I think he was quite happy to play along with persona, wasn't he, at the time? I mean, because he was so driven to just win the whole time. But I think he's a great pundit as well. He's knowledgeable, he's good, he's engaging, funny. So anyway, he seems up for this evening. I've no idea what it entails quite, but
jealous.
Are you well-versed in your trance music or...?
In the younger days, I used to like a bit of trance back in the mid to late 90s, but... curious to hear what his sets would be like and what sort of music it's like.
It's like a jam session. He was just saying everyone's just going to plug in and we take it from there. And I've no idea quite what it entails, but it's quite funny.
So our guest today, tell us a bit about him, Matt.
Well, we came up with him as a result of a sporting clip specifically, I think. It's Finn Taylor. And did you, you sent it to me, I think, didn't you?
Yeah. Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very funny.
Say about the clip.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was going to wait until we spoke to him, but I guess the premise of it was he was on some sort of panel when the NFL, you know, there's an American football match, a game was taking place in London. And he was on this panel as a representative of the UK and basically asked about his experiences and his love or his at least interest in American football, and him kind of saying that most people that are into American football from the UK are a little bit strange because, you know, not your average sports fan. And, you know, I likened it to saying to some American, you know, if a friend of yours was watching Test cricket at 3 a.m., in Boston, you know, would you think that was normal behavior kind of thing? So he's very, very funny. And the Americans weren't quite sure how to take him, you know. But they love it. They love a sort of quirky Brit, don't they, the Americans?
Yeah, he definitely is in that clip. Well, I mean, probably we'll open chatting about that. So we'll speak to him in a second. One thing I do have to warn, I don't think it's going to happen, but I was meant to have someone coming to unblock the drains at between 8 and 1. It hasn't happened. So if suddenly I disappear momentarily,
you'll tap out.
That's the exciting. But anyway, I shall let him in because he's here now.
Lovely.
Hello.
Hey. Hi, Finn.
Can you
Welcome.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, all right? Loud and clear.
Great.
Thank you so much for joining us. We're very excited.
Thank you.
We've just been singing your praises before you came on. So,
Oh, yeah. You into all the naughty stuff? I was surprised when I got the email.
So it was sport that brought you to our attention, or specifically NFL. We just mentioned it briefly just before you came on, but that sensational appearance of yours, was that fun doing that? I mean, we've partly explained it, but maybe explain how the backstory was to you being...
Are we in the podcast now?
Yeah,
we're
straight into it.
Got a lot of respect for that. it was an enormous amount of fun. I didn't, obviously it became this like big thing, but I think that was more in part of how skittish they were and how American, like their reactions made it really. I mean, the whole backstory is that I had this call with them. They were doing a week of shows in London, that NFL show. And I was going to be like their reporter on the ground because I'd done some writing work for their production company previously. And then I found out that they weren't going to pay me. They were just paying me in quotes exposure, which I thought was bullshit. so I thought, well, I'll just go on the show. I'll just do it once. And then I genuinely don't like NFL. I think I made that quite clear. And so I just sort of thought of some stuff to say in the car there, not thinking it would turn into this thing, but yeah, their reactions kind of made it, and I think it kind of distilled this British versus American sensibility and humor so well. Maybe that's why it went as big as it did. But no, it was a lot of fun.
It is sensational, and the people in the background as well, and just all of them don't know how to react. It's sort of slightly skin crawling in some ways, and not in others. So it's perfect.
Yeah, a lot of fun.
But it's cricket is your love in terms of sport, isn't it?
Test cricket. The oldest, snobbiest, yeah, that's me. I like Test cricket is my big thing. And I play cricket, badly, village cricket. I mean, I don't know if you, I'm so into the clips that go around of village cricket fails. Yeah. I absolutely love those, especially start of the season now. Everyone's out of practice. Now, it's April as we're recording, all the clips start going around of, village teams meeting up, wearing jumpers, wearing like black shoes. I love all that. So I played cricket a bit at school, but really fell in love with it with the Michael Vaughan England team and the Ashes series. And then, I've just been obsessed with England Test cricket ever since, really. And I've been to watch them a few times in home games. I keep meaning to like sign up to an amateur team, but I have two small kids and I'm touring, so I don't think my wife quite gives me the leeway to just start amateur cricket on top of that. But yeah, I'd say I'm probably a devastating slow to medium pace right arm line and length. Are you guys into cricket?
Yeah, I love it. Yeah, I play for a team here called Bushwhackers. We play indoor cricket in the spring and winter. just by Gloucestershire Cricket Ground. So we play indoors there. Oh, and then we play a series of Maverick games in the summer. But I mean, we've got enough material per season for those sort of clips for that you see doing the rounds. I mean, there's some absolute belters. You know, I didn't wear spikes in the game I played, and this wonderful thing slipped over, lands flat on my arse, just sort of muddy arse on the, you know, scrambling. Everyone's laughing. They almost didn't run me out. They're laughing so much at this calamitous individual just sprawling, crawling, running, everything to try and get in. And obviously,
I think that is the best is when there's an obvious chance for a run out. And then the batsman clearly knows he's run out and so just gives up. But then they miss the run out and then they start sprinting and then they get run out anyway. That's the best one, is when you see them give up and throw their bat and then go, oh, shit, I'm not out. Also, I think it's probably the greatest gap in professional and amateurs cricket of any sport.
Like, you're not seeing cycling, though. No.
Well, I was going to say, Chris, no offense, but cycling, you know, once you can cycle... I mean, I'm not trying to do down your achievement, but also part of me is like, I reckon if I cut out most things in my life, I could just cycle. Was it speed? Is that what you won the medals for?
Speed or distance? Speed, yeah. So only cycle for less than a minute. So yeah, not even
really
even bothered to go far. Yeah, it's basically something that literally 99% of the population can do. In fact, I had a few people on Twitter tell me that over the years. But yeah.
I'm
riding a bike. My granny could ride a bike.
I think, obviously, I don't know cycling as well as I think, but I guess the fact that everyone can do it, I mean, not everyone can play cricket people can cycle to work and not do what you did, but they can still cycle. People cannot even bowl a ball. Like, they fall over and throw the thing into their nuts trying to bowl. Like, it's just so funny. The amateur cricket, and I guess maybe amateur cycling isn't funny. That's my point.
Well, it can look funny, I suppose, to a lot of people. The gear, the outfits, and I think the more seriously you take something, the more funny it is. You know, when
that's definitely true.
That are just, you know, this is not to be laughed at. A bit like, I don't know, Morris dancing is an example of it. It looks like there's protocol and there's outfits, and you've got to do this certain way. And if you're into it, you're into it. And from the outside.
And there's also a strange racial element with the kind of, it seems to be a safe space to black up still in society and Morris dancing. They don't call it that. I don't think anyone really calls it out. And in my eyes, it is just blacking up. From the countryside, it's sort of fine. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I mean, for cricket, I was born and raised in Edinburgh, so not cricket's not a massive sport in Scotland.
Yeah.
So I've learned a lot actually through this podcast, mainly through Matt, because his love is cricket.
Yeah.
A few guests on who are really into it. But once we're filming for Question of Sport, and it was the mystery guest thing, and I was standing in the nets in this place near Manchester, and it was just all close ups of me with all the gear on and the helmet, so you could only just see the eyes and all that stuff. But for one, and there was a bowler who was sort of doing some of the actual bowling. And I said, go on then, just, you know, I had all the gear on, had the pads and everything. Go on. I just want to see what it's like to have the ball be sort of bowled towards me. And he must have done it half pace or whatever. But even at that, you know, he was being very gentle with me. But my God, it was terrifying. And the you've got this ball which is rock hard and the mass of it coming towards you at that speed. It gave me, like any sport, when you experience a little bit of it live, you have a whole
new... Yeah, it's like seeing tennis live. It's totally different seeing on TV. You're like, Jesus Christ, this is lethal. And then and you have a whole newfound respect for ball boys or what they called the Wimbledon. Yeah, they're older. Yeah, but they dodge it like the Matrix, don't they? You see them just do that.
Yeah.
But it's going so fast.
I think, though, when you're saying a lot of them are a bit older, and the pace with which the balls can just... Often, I think they know it's not going to hit them, but it can miss them by 6 inches, and it flies past their head. They just don't even move, as if like, yeah, that was miles away. They must have that experience.
They've got to be signing some form, like the liability is not on the players, is it?
Yeah, exactly. Although, I wonder what happens when the players lose their rag, because it's happened a few times where they've thrown their racket and it's hit a ball boy. In fact, you must remember specific instances, Matt, where they've been disqualified for...
Yeah, Djokovic was in the US Open. He was the favourite and he threw... Did he throw his racket or hit the ball? I think he hit the ball and it hit the line judge, and he got immediately disqualified because there's no... Like, it's a hard and fast rule. If you hit an official with racket or ball, doesn't matter if it was unintentional.
Use your fists.
Your game over.
But hang on, this is outside of the actual play.
No, this happened in like a fourth round of the US Open, maybe 3 years ago or something.
Yeah, but was it in between like...
Oh, in between points, yeah. Like in sort of frustration.
During live play, yeah.
Yeah, so that was quite bad.
Otherwise, that would be a kind of fun element to add to tennis. If you hitting the oldest line judge, you win automatically. And if you can knock out a ball boy, it's disqualified.
I like it when they lose it. You know, there was someone the other day who was actually smashing his racket against the umpire's chair, totally bananas. Yeah. You know, they can just implode so immediately. There was Mikhail Yuzhny, was this Russian dude who used to smash his racket over his head until it drew blood. And I thought, you're a fantastic nutcase.
Yeah.
It was weirdly captivating.
I used to watch that and never understand why they were doing that and why they get to that point of absolute rage. Because I'd never really experienced that in my sport. And then I had kids, and then I kind of understand it now.
Yeah.
When you've got young kids, things can drive you to absolute, you just lose the plot and you turn into an Incredible Hulk.
Yeah, and you're just smashing a swing ball racket against a pole. Yeah, you know,
makes sense.
It's funny that, like, I always think that tennis players are as angry as golfers should be. Like, golfers don't lose it, really, in the way that tennis players do. And yet golf is way more of a frustrating sport. Golf is the hardest sport to play, I think. And yet professional golfers don't seem to have meltdowns in the way that tennis players, I mean, tennis players are all rich kids as well. So that is it's quite stroppy, isn't it? When you see a tennis player, because all the professionals had millions of pounds of training and stuff and moved around.
I think at least with tennis, there's a physical element to it, where you can get that frustration out. Whereas golf, it's about being restrained and not hitting the ball too hard, not swinging too fast, trying to maintain that consistency. So you're absolutely right. You think that frustration has got to go somewhere. Whereas in tennis, you can...
Yeah, I reckon the caddy's getting a lot of it. I reckon they're whacking the caddy.
But also, if you... Because in the some instances where they do lose it in golf and you see them snap their club over their leg, or I think Rory McIlroy just hurling it into the water... They then don't have that club, so it's your putter or the driver. You're then without it. Whereas in tennis, you've got like six rackets in your bag or whatever, so you can smash one up. But these guys actually then have to play rounds without the necessary
club. That would be another fun element to add to golf, is that every time you lost a hole, you have to get rid of a club or something like that. That would be fun.
Do you like golf or no? You're not a fan?
I do like golf. I like, if it's on, I'll watch it. I love the Masters.
Yeah.
I haven't watched it this year, but... when it was on BBC, I used to watch all the time. Yeah, but I've got my granddad. My granddad was from Edinburgh, and he played a lot. And he gave me his clubs before he died. I've got them in the shed, but I'd play. I had a couple of lessons when I was a teenager. But yeah, I think it's, you know, I've got young kids. When the kids are a bit older and the marriage is teetering, that's when you get into golf, right? That's when... You think, I'm going to run away from my problems. I'm not going to do therapy. I'm going to get into golf. That's the middle-aged male response, isn't it, to domestic trauma.
So, or you buy a bike, it seems to be at this
sure,
at that age.
Yeah, you know. Just run around. Is that when you took it up?
Yeah, mid-40s. Yeah.
One of those guys.
I don't know how people get the golf. Like, I'd love to do it, but it's just hours, and you just got takes up the whole weekend. I guess you've got to properly love it, haven't you? I find it too frustrating.
Or hate bandwidth. Yeah.
What was it Michael Schumacher said about a journalist asked if he played golf? He said, no, I still make love to my wife. You know. So in terms of others, I mean, were you into sport as a kid?
I was into sport, but I was fat. I was one of the fat kids at school. So my love of sport was always tinged with an irony. I mean, I've always had a good touch at football, and now I basically grew taller, which is how I sort of lost the weight, and without any real kind of dietary changes. And so I'm now surprisingly okay at football. I have a good touch, and I can boss it if needed. Football's the one sport I played like consistently. So I play comedians football on Tuesday afternoons, and
who's in that? Because we had someone, I'm sure we had someone on here who's doing it Tuesday afternoon.
It's a big mailing list, and it's normally it's whoever's free. It's normally you get to about seven or eight a size. It's good fun.
Who are the superstars of Tuesday comedy football?
Tim Key is surprisingly good.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Like, much better than you'd think to look at.
Wow.
There's a lot of
sidekicks, does he?
Yeah.
Sidekicks, reference there.
Yeah, lots of them kicking sideways, passing it sideways. He does genuinely, he gets the ball and he'll run round the back of his own team and then down the other wing and to the goal. Like, he has this very weird, it always seems to work though. It's like what they used to say about Arjen Robben, that you know what he's going to do, but you can't stop him doing it. He will get the ball, the halfway line, run backwards and then run all the way to the opposition goal. Tim Key's very good. Snoll Fielding is meant to be amazing. I've never played with him, but when he used to play, really? Apparently he's much, yeah, weirdly, you wouldn't think to look at him. But anyway, so I was into football as a kid, but I went to a private school where football was seen as a kind of dirty, poor sport. So only when you got to sixth form were you allowed to play what was called, quote, recreational sport, which was when you and the heavily dyspraxic kids played football. So I was forced to play rugby, which I hated. I still just kind of have too much PTSD from being forced to play it. I actually enjoy watching it because I think rugby is like, it's so brutal in that it's basically natural selection, isn't it? There's a different game. If you're fat, it's a different game to if you're normal size. Like, it's fun if you're small and you can run around and dodge tackles. But if you were my size, you just have to basically rut with the other fat kids and a sweating pipe. It's horrible. It's really horrible. You don't get to do any of the fun stuff. So I remember I used to get into loads of trouble because I'd just lose my rag and I'd just charge at a ball, which I think is a crime. It's a whatever you call it, foul. It's not a crime.
A crime. It depends how you do it, I suppose.
Yeah. That's right. I had a knife on me. Maybe that was the Yeah. No. I remembered. I have a visceral memory of we were playing like the year below us or something, and I'd lost it, and it was a bit of a hill, and I just ran down the hill and just slammed into a bunch of. I don't know, maybe I was 14, they were 12 or something. Anyway, I got sent off. So didn't like rugby, still don't. Cricket, we played a bit in the summer. We played a lot of bin cricket. That was my, you know, similar to how the Brazilian poor kids will play street football. The Oxfordshire middle-class posh kids will play bin cricket, which is where you get a wheelie bin and a tennis ball and a textbook. And, It was always sort of represent the kind of dying overs of like a Pakistan tour or something where there's about, you know, 11 men around the bat and you're sort of trying to spin it as much as possible. So we used to invent loads of games, loads of mad sports. Back in the day when phones were not like what they are, when phones were like bricks, me and my friend Paddy invented a game which was sort of like clay pigeon shooting, where we had these Nokia 3310s, and one of you would throw them in the air, the other one had to try and throw their one and hit it out of the air, and they survived because they're just absolute units.
Wow.
So I wouldn't do that now with iPhones.
You know, and about 1700 quid as well. I couldn't believe believe the price of an iPhone. So I'm getting off a different topic here, but yeah, so you chuck the phones in the air and you would just wouldn't.
So one of you would go, the great thing was you would just be walking. And then one of you would go, pull, and the other one would go, oh, fuck. And you'd have to get the other one out and throw it in the air. And then you'd just get your phone and try and hit it. And you'd do it on grass, normally.
Ah, okay.
You wouldn't do it, yeah.
And they were never destroyed in collision because they were just solid bricks.
No, I mean, sometimes, like, the plastic came off, but you just slipped it back in, you know. Yeah. Those things were built properly, those things. And it didn't have our entire life. Like, now, if I lose my phone, I have a panic attack. Back then, it was just, well... That one girl I know isn't texting me back, so who gives a shit if I lose my phone?
I think the peak stress with phones was about maybe 5 or maybe even 10 years ago, when your life was on your phone, but it didn't have this ease of transference of all the data. You know, everything's in the cloud. You can buy a new phone. You just lost it, you just go, yeah, it's from backup. If you haven't lost it and you've got an old phone, you just sit next to it. You turn your back and you pick it up and it's exactly where you picked up from the old phone. It's amazing.
Yeah.
The stress. I don't understand how they do it, but it's, yeah, the stress is kind of gone from it. But in the old, you know, 5, 10 years ago, when you had a phone, an iPhone or whatever, and you lost it, it was like, oh my God, what am I going to do? You know, I don't even know my password. How am I going to open up all this stuff? How am I going to get my email? It was, that was probably stressful, but I think we're past that point now, hopefully.
Yes, yeah, new stresses now, I think. Yeah. So yeah, and then we were made to do lots of I guess you'd call them Commonwealth Games sports, athletics, is that what they're called?
Yeah.
Sorry, I do use Commonwealth Games as a kind of pejorative. I do find that stuff quite boring. Apologies if that's what you built your name on. But
I used to love bowls as a kid, as like an 8, 9, 10 year old kid. I used to watch the Commonwealth Games and watch basically pensioners playing a game. And I used
Is that Commonwealth bowls and Commonwealth?
Crown bowls, lawn bowls, whatever you call it.
My granddad used to love crown bowls. I'm a big fan of petanque on holiday.
Oh, I love it.
Petanque, yeah.
That's not in the Commonwealth, so.
No, but I guess the thing that I'm best at, sport-wise, is table football. I'm not joking, I will beat anyone at table football.
Is this a misspent youth?
Yeah. So there was a table football table in our common room at school, and me and my same friend Paddy, who used to throw phones near, we were not doing that. We would just spend every break time getting aggressively good at it. And then there were a few times where we could get into pubs underage. We'd challenge people to play and we'd go 5-0 down and then we'd say, oh, do you want to put some more money on it? And then we'd beat them 10-5, like it was a switch. We did that a couple of times in pubs and felt very cool about it. But yeah, it's a thing now where like if you go on a stag do or like a big group holiday and there's a table football table, I'll be like, oh, I'll play. And then I never get to play again because no one wants to play with me because it is unfair.
Have you never met your match then? Have you never met someone that could come close
Paddy,
to you?
Paddy, who, yeah, he's probably better than me. So, he's the one guy who I would fear playing. And I'm sure there is a whole subculture of table football people who probably are better than me, but I'm not better than them yet.
Would that be your sporting hire then, getting money off strangers? Table football in pubs, or
yeah, I mean, when you put it like that, it sound like
I perhaps didn't bill it so well, but
yeah, I guess that's the peak of my sporting achievement. Is that time in the Goose in Oxford when I basically robbed a drunk £5. Yeah, it probably is. Christ,
I never realised that table football can be so sort of violent and fast. I just thought it was a game that you could play. I played a little bit as a kid. And I was at an event a couple of years ago, and Fabian Cancellara is a famous Swiss cyclist guy. He was Olympic champion. He's won loads of big events. And they were just wanting to get some shots of us. He said, can you both play the table football? We'll get some pictures of you on social media, little videos. And I thought, yeah, we'll have a little game here. And he just switched on this different level. Like he'd sort of gone into God level of table football.
Yeah.
And I'd never seen anything like it before. I thought, right, okay, I'm not having that. And I was trying my hardest. And I didn't even see which way the ball. Like, there was one bit where he scored a goal and I hadn't even seen. I heard the noise, but I couldn't see the ball. And it was in my goal.
It's such a good noise as well. It's so fine.
Yeah. Yeah.
And like a gunshot, dead goal.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it is. And it's a kind of dirty secret, I guess, because most people think table football is just spinning. Oh, you just spin it. But then there are those of us who are kind of, who have spent much like monks, sworn celibacy 5 years reading whatever religious texts. I was also celibate, but not through my own choosing. just playing table football for 5 years.
Thanks to table football.
I went through that transition period with my son, though. I used to play with him and, let him win or make it close and then let him win. And now it's gone beyond that. It's gone to the point that it doesn't matter how hard I try, I cannot get close to him anymore. And he just laughs in my face to make it even worse.
At table football?
Yeah, absolutely.
Have you got one in the house?
Yeah, we're about to give it away because I can't face it anymore. Put it out on the street for someone to have. But yeah, he's just fantastic. And I can't see how I can get to that level. And he just toys with me. So any tips? No, too late probably.
That is the thing, though, is that when you get to a certain level, it is like playing with a cat or a cat playing with a mouse kind of thing.
That's how it feels.
It's evil. It is really evil. It's punishing. There's nothing quite like an uneven table football game.
How old are your kids, Ben?
My daughter will be 3 in July and my son is 6 months. So, yeah.
So you're not at that point yet of your kids getting to the tipping point where they start to be able to beat you or close to beating you then?
I'm nutmegging my door every day. I'm ripping it to shreds with the ball. Yeah.
Well, I mean, my daughter,
I'm turning her, she's falling over.
Yeah. My kids are 6 and 5. Six and nine. And my six-year-old daughter, I play a game with her where you put your hands together and you put the fingertips end to end.
Yeah.
And one person gets to slap the other hand.
Yeah, slaps it.
And you sort of open your hand, you pull away. And if you miss, then the other person does it. And obviously, you're sort of letting them win. And I've got to the point now where her reactions are so good that I'm genuinely unable to pull it away. Where she can, I mean, obviously, a six-year-old's not going to slap you too hard, so it's okay. But
have you ever gone too hard and really hurt her? Something like, oh, fuck, because you're so in it.
No such thing as too hard. You just, they've got to learn. They've got to learn.
It's Scotland, isn't it? It's Scotland, sorry. Different world up there.
We've got something in common. Your daughter was born first. She was premature.
Yeah, she was born 33 weeks. She was born.
My firstborn as well, Calum. He was 29 weeks. So we had, had a stay at neonatal. 29. No, it's thumps. I'm not. We're not trying to peak you.
I just checking you hadn't said 39, and I was like, oh, that's not technically the class that I said at all.
But yeah.
So yeah, we were in neonatal for 7 weeks in the end. We were there for quite a while. And it was during the Euros, actually, the summer where England got to the final. So I remember actually just after the birth, Amanda, my wife, got moved to normal post-labor ward. But obviously my daughter was still upstairs in the unit. But you could basically hear all these different timed. Yes, because basically England were hammering Ukraine, which now, in a good way, it's different. The world's changed. Can't take quite as much joy out of Ukraine getting pulverized. Anyway, all the dads were watching England beat Ukraine in the Euros. That must have been a couple of days after she was born. But yeah, so how long were you in NICU for then? A
couple of months, yeah. Eight weeks, yeah. Callum was in for. But I was listening to you on, I think it was Russell Howard's podcast, and really interesting, a lot of the stuff you were talking about there, exactly the same experiences of, the dread of going in and you're aiming for that day when you can take them out of the hospital. But as soon as you do, you're terrified because you don't have the machines, you don't have the security of the hospital around you.
I wonder if you had the same thing with your second, is that when we had our second and he was quote normal, I remember being like, well, how do we know what is, if he's breathing, like, how do we know what his oxygen levels are? Because they just give you him and he's like fine. And I'm like, well, hang on. No. We need to hook him up so I can see. I spent so long, like, because my daughter was discharged on oxygen. So we had loads of sleep tests for about 5 months afterwards, those little computers with the numbers in our house. So I'm so used to seeing those numbers. And I was like, well, how do we know he's fine? And they're like, well, he's fine. And I was like, it's only when you have, it's only when we had the second that you realize how unusual / different whatever the first one was.
Yeah, it's not a particularly pleasant experience, and it's hard to explain. It's just so all the rules don't apply to you as a parent of a premature child. It's just such a different experience, and there's no answer. All you wanted answers or sort of definite dates, or you want something sort of concrete
and
from the doctors.
And you base your entire moods over what that particular doctor that day says, and they're always different, and they're reading your child differently every day. And so you'd come in and you'd think, well, yesterday they said really positive noises, maybe we're looking at 2 weeks, and then you'd have just some grumpy guy who was like, oh no, blah, 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 blah. And then your whole day would be knocked out of whack, and then you'd come in again and then a nurse you didn't like was on shift, and it's a whole different thing. But once you're out, you do kind of forget about it, weirdly. And as I think I might have said this on Russell's pod, but because my second one was like, he got admitted for a couple of days just because he didn't poo. Didn't pass his first poo, and so it meant that my daughter went and met him in the same unit that she was in. And a lot of the same nurses and doctors were there. And seeing her as like a 2-year-old tearing round, causing chaos in a neonatal unit, like slapping incubators, you know, it was kind of this real like full circle therapy moment. And I'm actually really glad that we wouldn't have got that if he hadn't been admitted. So it's quite a nice silver lining.
It must be wonderful being a nurse or a doctor in one of these wards, and you see, you know, your former patients come back, because it must be quite incredible, really, when you see, because it's hard to explain to people who haven't been into a neonatal ward just how small a premature baby can be, a 24-weeker, you know.
Yeah, right, then.
Half a kilo in weight when they're born, some of them, you know, you just
think
it's absolutely...
They don't look human until...
No.
I'd say maybe 28, 29. Like, before that, they're like these little animatronic... They look like something out of special effects from a film. Like these little animatronic birds, almost, and they're hooked up to all these tubes and stuff. And it's frightening. But then to see that thing, like running as a sort of driven toddler, must be amazing.
be so stressful, though. How do you? At what point do you chill out? Like when your daughter comes home, or in your case, Callum. Like at what point do you?
I don't think relax I've chilled out. I don't think I've chilled out for 3 years. I think you can tell me that. How old are your kids, Matt?
They're a lot older, actually. They're 15 and 12. They were both born
5 weeks early.
They were both 5 weeks early. One was a bit, had to stay in hospital for 5-6 weeks, but like nothing like that. I mean, he was sort of normal weight, etc.
I think that's the other hard thing. But that's the hard thing about whenever you have kids, is that you're so knackered. Like the birth is obviously wipes out the mother, and as the father, you're staying in that. There should be a common space for dads to talk about the chairs they have to sleep on in hospitals, but it's never really the time. After the mother was just pushed out, for you to go, I like to sleep on this fucking thing. It's never really, but there should be a safe space for us to talk about how bad those chairs are. Anyway, you start like Pete, the most knackered you've ever been, and then you never get it back. Because you're just now a parent of a newborn. So it's not as if you can go into it refreshed, is it? That's the worst thing.
Yeah, that's it forever. Knackered.
Yeah, done.
Are you out the other side of it with the 6 months one, or are you still not got a good sleeper there?
It's completely chaos. Yeah. we tried sleep training him, but he likes a dummy, which I first didn't. So apparently if they like dummies, you have to wait till they learn how to be able to put it back in. I don't know. it's just chaos. I mean, I've just accepted that the toddler won't do what I wanted to, and the other one won't sleep. And I just, whatever, we'll just get on with it.
Yeah, acceptance is quite a big moment.
I think that is a big thing. Yeah. There's no point fighting against it. You've made it.
Do you get to the point now with your touring, when you're away touring or you've got gigs on, and to your wife's... Sorry, it's going to have to be an overnight stay. We don't want to have to go, but I know it's only 10 miles away, but I definitely have to stay.
I know it's just Milton Keynes, but you know, I've got to stay over, I'm afraid. Sorry. Yeah. No, it is. That is a benefit, I'll be honest. And it also, like, I'm staying in some pretty cheap hotels, but even like the Plymouth Travel Lodge. What a night that was. Like 9 hours. Lovely view of the car park. I mean, honestly, the worst hotel is now the height of luxury for me on tour. Yeah, I'm going to Ireland next week. That's 3 nights. That's going to be really great. I don't care about the show. It's just 3 nights away on the trot.
You don't want to show off how refreshed you are when you come back, because that's fatal.
No, it is. And you just get thrown in through the door. You just have to muck in and... there's quite a lot of sitting in the car outside for a good sort of 20 minutes. You've already arrived. But you're
savoring the last moments.
Silence, yeah. Watching the outside of the house, thinking, in your head, you're seeing like the cartoon, you just the dust clouds and everything, and you're just in the car listening to birdsong. Yeah. But touring, I mean, we have extended into the autumn, the tour, and that's because people are buying tickets, but also because they were like, oh, would you want to do it? I'm like, yeah, no, sign me up. I'll be there. Let's keep this thing going as long as possible, yeah.
What's the tour called? Oh, go on. Same question.
That was my question, mate.
The tour is called Ask Your Mother, and I think the blurb is that comedian your mother doesn't like you seeing is back on the road. It's sort of 70 minutes of stand-up that, you know, if you like the clips I do, it's the similar sort of tone. And yeah, it's kind of the main anger is just letting out a lot of the anger of having two small kids, and it's a good release valve for me, the stage.
And there's a lot of people can relate to that as well, I guess, in the audience, can't they? I mean, there's so many.
Yeah, it is a really bad time in your life in many ways. I mean, it's filled with joy, of course, you know. But no, it is. I think it's a healthy, cathartic thing for people to go and just sort of revel in how shit it can be, or how shit a lot of it is. Yeah,
it's, I think, sleep deprivation. It's dealing with illogical beings that just cannot. You cannot reason with a 2-year-old or a 3-year-old.
No.
And it's having, if you've never been exposed to that before, like myself, really, my first experience of that was with Callum, and then you have a second one, and it's just like, oh my God, you know what? There's times where you say the joy, the sheer joy of being a father is unlike anything else, but equally, it just opens up a whole new level of emotion.
Just emotional
good and bad.
Yeah. It's like you're seeing them happy is the happiest you'll ever be. But then also, you're only as happy as your least happy child.
That's it.
So if one of them is having a meltdown, you're having a meltdown, and it's not something you can explain to people, because it's like we've all seen kids have meltdowns. You go, oh, that's bad. But when it's your kids, your insides are on fire. It's like you also love them more than anything, and it'd be so much easier if you didn't, wouldn't it? Like if you were a sort of psychopathic being / terrible parent who didn't love your kids, then being a parent wouldn't be difficult, because you'd just be like, wow, I'll shut the door and you can let you cry. You know?
Yeah.
So we start with thinking about signing my daughter up to Little Kickers, actually. Are your kids sporting them, Chris? I imagine
try not to put pressure on them, but I was going to ask you this question about what kind of sport are you, do you want to try and do something that you've got a passion for, so you can have that, spend that time with your kids and bond with them, like kicking a ball or playing cricket or whatever.
Well,
or do you just try lots of different things?
Obviously, I'd love my son to open the batting for England, obviously. I don't know if, you know, I think with the daughter, it's pretty clear that's not going to happen. I mean, you can see coordination early doors, can't you? I mean, yeah, obviously it would be ideal if one of them got really into cricket. I will be taking them both to like the 100, you know, the gateway drug, trying to get them, shuffle them along the line past 220 into the test stuff. Obviously, it might just be that's what their boring dad likes. Fine. I mean, it would be a nice irony, but I would also be crushed if one of them got obsessed by American football. It would be difficult for my brand to have to be seen like playing NFL with my kids.
That's you as a parent, the one thing you'll disapprove of is NFL and nothing else.
Yeah,
and they're bound to defy it.
I'll accept them whatever they are.
They can smoke, they can take drugs, but no NFL. Yeah,
they can do whatever they want. But if they can't say they're a linebacker, I'm kicking them out. Yeah.
What was it as a cricket fan, as a youngster? I know you got into it in some ways a bit later, but was there like a batsman or a bowler you aspired to be when you were a kid, or was it not like that for you?
I loved Simon Jones, the Welsh fast bowler whose career was cut short, who was sort of the unsung hero of the 2005 Ashes. There's a noise that has become a kind of viral thing amongst cricket fans. The noise of Michael Clarke's off stump.
Oh, yeah.
Uproot. Yeah, yeah, there you go. The certain type of man, that's exactly what I'm talking about. But that, there's a lot of very funny clips where they start sort of like, it starts like sexual, and then it, the noise, the climax is Michael Clarke's off stump being ripped out. because for a certain group of men, that is better than sex, is saying whatever. Yeah, so Simon Jones, reverse swing, I always found that incredibly alluring. The ability to, it's just deception, isn't it? It's pure mastery of a ball at that speed to just go in like that. I loved Freddie Flintoff. That was, you know, the kind of swaggering, just clobbing it around. But yeah, I always sort of as a joke, but also I think practically, I just quite like the idea whenever we used to play cricket, like properly or like, you know, with stumps and a bat, I would always just play ruthlessly defensively, which is not what you're meant to do when it's just like some kids playing. I'd always just try and grind them down and stay in. Just because I thought that was the funniest thing to do, because everyone else was trying to score big shots and I'd just sort of no run, leave it, and just try and grind them down. Just then in the end, they would just lose interest and we'd have to stop playing. So maybe that's what I'd, if I ever did start playing, I'd become a ruthlessly boring, defensive, safety-based, like Dom Sibley, you know, just leaving absolutely everything outside off.
It's sort of, Chris, in this day and age where England are swashbuckling and hitting runs everywhere, Dom Sibley is sort of proudly scores one from 47 deliveries. It's like properly nice old
one
school.
One knockout.
Yeah.
It's weird that, because he was right on the tail end of the era before this, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Him and Crawley were the opening partnership for a bit, which seems mad.
I think they were, yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting. But you talked on Russell's podcast about Test cricket and the fact it's 4 or 5 days. In fact, it's almost the antithesis of all the sports that are getting condensed and made for TV, like the T20 or all these other sports that are following suit and trying to make it appealing to the audiences and stuff. But it's almost the opposite of that you're drawn to, isn't it?
I think if the sport is 5 days long, then there's a broader canvas for all the kind of drama and narratives that are why sport is exciting, right? And seeing that get crunched down into a, like you say, TV ready format, I think kind of for me what I like about it is the fact that someone can dominate a day and the next day 3 wickets fall quickly and suddenly you're in a whole new chapter of this thing, and the game is played every match is sort of played twice within the game, and that everyone has 2 innings, so there's a chance for redemption. And I think it also just fits this something about the English summer as well, just sitting outside listening to the radio of this kind of intermittently boring and then very exciting. I really like the fact it's long, and there's all these moves to try and. They're always talking about making Test a day shorter, but nothing beats the drama of a fifth day, eh, Matt? That's what they always say.
Yeah.
Something whenever there's a great Test match, they always say, this is a great advert for a fifth day. Yeah.
England don't normally get to a fifth day these days with the way they play it.
They don't normally get to a third. get it. Yeah, cricket is the main love. And then football, I mean, my dad used to take me to Chelsea all the time, and we're actually going tonight, first time I will have been for a long time. It's just got so... like the money side of it's just got so ridiculous that it seems I don't know, it's not to me, it's just not as attractive sport
did
to
you
watch
did you read that in the last financial year Chelsea spent 75 million on agent fees?
Wow. Yeah,
the whole of the Premier League spent something like 400 million, but Chelsea alone spent 75 million pounds for nothing, just for agent fees. Like,
yeah,
that's
but also I feel ludicrous. Like tactically football has almost it's been in the same place for ages, and now everyone's trying to do the same thing. So the games aren't as. Do you ever watch that thing on Sky Sports, like Premier League years, where they used it's always quite funny because they try and intersperse old football games with sort of quite terrible news events from the year to try and give it context, and then they try and link it. They go, "Oh, September 2001, the towers fell, but up front for Manchester United, you're in goal." It's always so jarring watching it. Whoever's writing those scripts is doing real legwork to try and link 9/11 with United's treble winning. Anyway, I always watch those games and think, God, there's so much space and teams were playing different styles, and you could still get, like, people were just still taking pot shots from 40 yards. And nowadays, it just feels like everyone is trying to pass it in and the pressing. And I don't think it's as good to watch football as it was, maybe. And maybe that's just because we're at the end of like a tactical era. I don't know. But I still, it's my childhood. So I still get sad if Chelsea lose, which is stupid. It is stupid. It's really stupid.
Yeah, because it doesn't matter when you essentially break it down, does it? But it seems to
matter.
It
doesn't matter at all.
Yeah.
It does not matter at all. And yet, because that was how me and my dad, spent our Saturdays for 5 years. It matters to me. So,
You think about it, it's just 11 people, 11 multimillionaires playing another 11 multimillionaires. But you do, once you invest an interest in that club and those random people with this same colored shirt on, it matters hugely,
Yeah, it's stupid. But
almost more than it matters to the players. You'd feel at times, you'd think there's some players that are think actually they care.
Yeah,
the fans
especially
care more
now,
than...
especially nowadays, where they're so, especially with Chelsea, where I genuinely couldn't tell you anyone in the starting. I mean, their squad seems to have changed like season to season in the last 2 years. So I just don't know who anyone's. It's like looking at a Pro Evo squad list where all the players have got slightly wrong names. And you're like, these are all, they don't have the license, so they're making them up. Do you guys support T? Are you Hearts or Hibs, or are you not into
it? I was Hearts. As a kid, I was Hearts. I mean, I've talked about this absolutely to the nth degree in this podcast about my heartbreak when I was 10. The headline is that Hearts should have won the double and they got nothing in the 85-86 season. They lost the league on goal difference. Celtic beat them in the final Saturday.
Wow.
I was a bit of a glory seeker. I chose Hearts because they were doing really well that year. So I only got an interest in football that year, really, the year before.
Yeah.
And my dad supported Hibs. So I'd basically gone against the grain. And I'd, you know,
imagine
that.
Yeah.
What was he?
He's from Edinburgh.
Imagine choosing the opposite to your dad, not just a different club, but the club that is the exact rival to your family club. So I did that because I was looking for a team that was going to win. Because basically, I asked my dad, so who do you support? Oh, I'll support Hibs. Are they any good? No, they're bloody awful. Like, well, why do you support them then? So, you know, who's the best in Scotland just now? Hearts are probably the best. And one, right, I'll support Hearts then. No, you can't do that. That's not how it works. Well, yes, it is. Yeah, that's who I'm going to support.
No,
so, yeah, I supported Hearts. And then
got
my payback.
This that thing in therapy, isn't there, where they say you're not meant to pass on generational trauma. And yeah, that is exactly what they're doing. You're going, no, I'm sad about this team, so you're going to be sad with me. I don't care. You don't get to choose.
No, that's exactly that. And Matt, who do you support again?
Well, I support Ipswich, but then my son supports Arsenal, so I've started having a soft spot for Arsenal. And he I can't remember if I said this on the podcast before, Chris, but he supports them for a ludicrous reason. When he was a kid, we were shopping on a road near where we live in Bristol and went to a charity store, and there was a Barcelona shirt or an Arsenal shirt, and he decided to buy the Arsenal shirt. And it had some random kid's name, Innes, on the back of it. So he used to say his favourite Arsenal player was Innes, but it was just some random kid in Bristol who'd grown out of his shirt. So that's quite nice when he tells people why he supports Arsenal, and that still sticks. So I kind of have a soft spot for them as well a bit.
Yeah.
And what other sports, apart from football or cricket, if you could be a professional in any sport at all, what would be your dream sport you've taken part in?
Well, the life of a golfer looks pretty cushy, doesn't it? go around these beautiful manicured resorts.
And the prize money is ridiculous as well.
Especially now the Saudis are involved. Yeah. I don't really get Formula One or most, you know, any of that stuff. Wouldn't want to be involved in that. I don't know. Something that you could, darts, because I was just about to say, you don't want to do something where you're dedicating, it takes over your life, and you know, darts, you can just live in a pub. Do you know what I mean?
At the age of 17, you can be the best in the world, you know.
Well, exactly, that Luke Littler guy.
Yeah.
It's very different to if you're a 17-year-old tennis prodigy and you're basically, you know, taken out of mainstream schools, you've got this expensive coach to keep your thing up, but really you're just sort of jet setting between the US and you know, you don't really get to have a childhood. This guy's just in a pub eating crisps and he's suddenly the champion dart, you know. So yeah. And also it seems that darts is essentially a footnote in the world's biggest stag do. Whenever I watch it on TV, it just seems to be going on while there are 3,000 stag do's happening in the background. So I reckon darts must be a good life, albeit probably a short one for health reasons.
What about your sporting misadventure? We had your sporting high of your table football in the Goose in Oxford or whatever it was, but have you got a particular sporting misadventure that you've encountered?
A low point, as it were.
Yeah.
Or
calamity or anything, really.
To offset that glorious high of robbing a drunk man in the Goose, yeah. Well, so as a fat child, as I said at school, there was another fat kid in my year who was from Thailand, and he was called Pi, P-I. But obviously, being fat and called Pi, he took a lot. Yeah, Chris has already laughed. He took a lot of the flack for me.
I was just thinking about something funny I heard yesterday. I wasn't laughing at.
Okay, sure.
Fat
sure.
Pie, yeah.
But he so. Was called the Olympian laughs at fat child, isn't a good
thing. Yeah, exactly.
Daily Mail headline tomorrow. It's disgrace to have been laughing fat Thai child.
Oh dear. Don't worry, we'll edit this bit out, Matt. Yeah, we'll get
it. No, of course. Oh, can I clip it up though? It's quite good for my picture, might be. But anyway, he took a lot of the flack because he was called Pi. But there was this, we were made to do cross country at school. Like, it was like the whole year group had to do this big cross country race. And I absolutely hated it. You know, I had dodgy knees because I was tall as well. This thing called Osgood Slatters, where I had like extra cartilage, my knees were always hurting. And I was overweight. So me and Pi this year, we must have been like 10, maybe, or 11. We decided as a sort of protest, we would like walk deliberately because we knew we were going to finish last. So we decided to walk the course, right? Yeah. And then, you know, obviously we started getting shouted at, told to try. We'd move a little bit, but then we'd walk and we'd be chatting at the back. And then basically the other kids who'd all finished started like cheering us on, going, oh, this is, you know, and it was almost like a, I'm not going to say it felt like I was in the civil rights march in the 60s, but there was an element of that in the atmosphere of like, God, these guys are really, they're doing it against the system. But these barbarians are making us run. Anyway, much to my shame, we got to about 10 yards of the finish line. And I thought, fuck it. And I just sprinted the last 10 yards so that I didn't come last. it's really terrible recounting it now, actually. It's really awful.
But how did Pi react to your late burst?
Well, yeah, I think he was quite shaken. And quite betrayed, I think, understandably. But I unlocked him. So I just decided I didn't want to come last after all that. Or maybe I thought it'd be funny, but it's probably more that I was driven by pride. And so I just sprinted the last 10 yards across the finish line and broke the truce that had lasted for about an hour of us sort of walking the... So that's probably the thing I feel the most sort of regret over, although even though it is quite funny, I do feel quite ashamed of that.
So well, kind of what you didn't realise,
yeah, that's
what you didn't realise, Finn, is we've actually got Pi on the line here.
He looks good now. Hi, Scott. He's lost a lot. He's lost the weight. I see him on socials. He's, yeah.
Who's laughing now?
And what about your comedy twist? When did that, was it as an early age that you thought you'd be going down that route, or was that a later?
No, it's very, very early. I mean, I lived in the school we went to. My mum ran the girls' boarding house. So we lived in the girls' boarding house. So I was the boy that lived in the girls' boarding house. So quite quickly, humor became my sort of defense mechanism, my way to kind of communicate through that sort of weird scenario. And also, like, I'm from like a sort of F-list performing family. Like, my dad was a professional musician for most of the 80s, and then he sort of quit when I was born. And my great aunt on my mum's side was on the variety circuit with Morecambe and Wise. And even if you go further back in that, again, that family tree, you've got like music hall acts that toured the British Empire. So it's all kind of, it's in the blood as well. But yeah, from pretty early age, I was showing off and performing. And then when I saw, my dad bought me the Blues Brothers on VHS on Christmas. And it was a 15, but I was maybe like 8 or 9, and I loved it. I got obsessed with it, and I watched it all back, like constantly, and wore the tape out. And then got into comedy through that and watched Monty Python a lot. And then I remember seeing Ross Noble on Live at the Apollo and thinking, oh, that's, I want to do that. So, yeah, I was, and then I you know, my school did debating and stuff, and I'd try and just sort of do mini bits of stand-up in debates and got into the trouble for being vulgar as a, you know, 14-year-old in competition. So yeah, it's kind of always been my personality. And yeah, the idea of doing anything else was quite frightening to me as a teenager, actually.
God, the idea of doing what you do is frightening to us, I think.
Well, yeah, I mean, if most people did it, they'd be fired, I guess, is the point. She's saying the things I say, but I've managed to carve out a space where I'm paid to do it. So, no, for some reason, it was scarier to not do it for me. I don't know why, but yeah, that was always... Yeah, honestly, I used to lie awake at night as a teenager worrying about what I would do if I couldn't do stand up. It seemed I had such blinkers on. I didn't really know what else there was that I can do.
And how far ahead do you plan? So if you've got a tour coming up, you're writing new material for that tour, but you must be constantly writing new material, preparing for the next stage. I mean, is it just endless, or do you go through phases of working on that and then just performing?
Well, yeah, I guess the thing is that you don't really write it in the way that I imagine you think you do. It's not like you sit down and write it. It's more that it's just always going. It's just a way of processing the world that's always going on in the back of your head. So a line will come to you, or a way of describing something, or you'll, in my case, my anger issues will flare up, and then I'll think of a way to channel that on stage. And so if you're performing, you're always writing because you're able to do it and get instant feedback and then try and rework it. And that's how it kind of, it's very organic. It's not like music where you could write a song in your bedroom and it is music. You're making music. Like, without an audience, it's not really stand up. So you have to kind of do it for it to exist. So if I'm doing a tour, then I'll just book in a load of club gigs, or I'll just pop into places unannounced and just try stuff out a lot. And then once you're on tour and the hour's kind of set in stone, you can just add the tweaks. And so, yeah, I'm only really doing the tour this year. I'm not really doing much other stuff live because it's all done. But then once that ends, I'll have a couple months off, and then, yeah, start going back into the snags and the hens and all that, and start trying to. You always have to make stuff work in front of people who don't know you. I think that's the key to it. So you're always having this process of being drastically humbled at the beginning, having just done this, like, you know, massive tour where everyone's coming to see you and wants to meet you afterwards, and then you go back to people who just couldn't give a shit about you, and you try and make them laugh. And that's the craft, I guess.
Do you like that bit the best, in a strange way, because that's the hardest bit to overcome? Or
yeah, the best bit is having the hour, and then it's making bits longer and adding to it and tweaking it, because it's never finished, really. I think if you think it's finished, then you get bored of it. So the best bit is, like, maybe about a month into the tour, it clicks into place and you think, right, that's the show. And then it's just you having fun with it and adding stuff. That's the best bit. The hardest bit is going from naught to 20 minutes when you've got nothing and you have to go on and do 20 minutes and you have nothing. And you hate all your old stuff, you're bored of it, and you need new stuff. So you just have to basically just eat shit. You just have to think, look, if there's anyone here who thinks they're a fan of me, I'm sorry, I'm going to be bad, because this is how this works. You just have to die. It's the only way to, you know, to get, well, you have to at least try stuff out, and normally stuff doesn't work the first couple of times. So yeah, do I like that bit? It is, it's worth it. It's good knowing that you have a thing later, you know, you have a theatre tour later to do the stuff too. That makes it worthwhile. It's definitely the most kind of, it's where you feel your brain is working the hardest, is when you're trying to get the bits to work in front of drunk people. Yeah.
How do you view the internet, or view social media? Do you see it as, a lot of comedians we've spoken to, it's a necessary evil? They don't particularly enjoy having to engage with it constantly. Is it something that you quite enjoy, or do you see it as a bit of a...
Yeah, I had a real bolt fast in that I was doing bits of TV. And it was all things were all sort of going quite well on paper, but I couldn't really sell tickets because I hadn't quite realised that TV doesn't really mean anything in the way it did 5-10 years ago. And then I sort of joined social media with intent. Like, I don't use it like, I'm not posting pictures of my beautiful family. You know, I don't use it like that. I post naughty clips that I write, and I make a show. And it's my sense of humor, and it's a lot of fun to make. And that's what sells the tickets. And so I like it because I get to make something that's I'm totally in creative control. And I think it's great. And the fact that it could potentially reach everyone who has a phone is amazing. It means that there's no, you know, just because someone didn't watch that episode of Have I Got News For You doesn't mean that you've lost a chance to sell a ticket. Now you can reach literally anyone. With stuff that you're proud of. I was never really that proud of anything I did on TV, because I always felt like I would have edited it better or differently, certainly. So I love it. I mean, I hate that it's in my pocket, maybe. I hate that it's I hate the habit I can't really control, like how much I check things. I should be on it less, but it's totally transformed my career. And it's very funny that I get recognized for that rather than for, you know, Flying with the Apollo, Bonus View. But it's just generational, isn't it? Just all that stuff's kind of on the way out, really. And it's all clips, isn't it?
I think your comedy works incredibly well on social media. There's some comedians who, no matter how you edit it, no matter what you do, it just doesn't quite work in a 30-second or minute-long clip. It just doesn't quite translate to it. Whereas, you know, some of the stuff on your channels have been, you know, literally laughing out loud like an idiot over the last few months. Just some real highlights. But the talking, the traitors guy, I've forgotten his name.
Yeah, I mean, Paul. He was
a good sport. I mean, goodness
me. He was a good sport. I mean, if I was his agent, I would have stopped him going on the show. But that's the great thing, is that he wanted to do it. We're always so thankful that people come on, and we're also always slightly confused as to why they do, but they do. So I'm not going to overthink it. But it's a lot of fun. And recording that show is so much fun in the room. Like, we're all just pissing ourselves all the time. Yeah, it's just very silly. It's very, very stupid. And you're right, that wouldn't work on TV because people would be trying to, they'd say, oh no, you can't say that, you shouldn't do that. But because I'm the boss, so the buck stops with me, which means the buck does not stop. It's just, no, if I think it's funny, I'll do it. I mean, if I watch the edit back and it works, I'll put it in. So yeah, I'm sure at some point that'll blow up my face, but for now it's
So your tour, Remainers Again, you know, where are you? Is it on for the next few weeks, months? How long have you got to go? Where
goes, on, goes on to, goes on till November now. We've just added a bunch of dates in the autumn. So July I'm off, but then I'll be at the Edinburgh Fringe for a few nights at the end of August. And then September, October, November, I do loads more cities. Bristol, Leeds again, Manchester, Dublin, Galway, Leicester. And then, yeah, May, I'm in Cambridge. Cambridge is sold out. Sheffield. There's a lot of tickets left for Sheffield. If this comes out, time for me to go to Sheffield. Anyone's listening in the Midlands, Sheffield, she comes to that one. But, I'm touring all year, basically. So tickets via the link in my bio and all that.
Brilliant. Well, thanks very much for the time. We've taken over an hour of yours, so we'll...
That's absolutely fine.
We'll leave you to practice your batting or bowling or whatever else you've got in store for the rest of the day.
I'll just be shadow batting while the kids nap. That's what I do. Always defensive, though. Always should be looking at
Thank you so much, Ben. Take care,
thanks, mate. Guys.
Brilliant. Yeah, take care. Guys. All the best.
So good luck. Bye. All the best.
Bye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com